And welcome once again to Natural Doc Radio. I'm Janet Cimarelli, licensed clinical nutritionist, and I'm here with Dr. Herb Slavin. And we are here at Natural Doc Radio to bring you the latest information on supporting your good health. Hi, Dr. Slavin.
Hi, Janet.
And do you have a specific subject on the agenda for today?
One of the things we do here is, instead of jumping to treat patient symptoms, is trying to look for the underlying cause of their problems. And when we do that, patients get better results than just taking a pill for their problem. But more importantly, they get the restoration of their health. And one of the, I would have to say, the major health issue of our day is obesity. And more importantly than that, it's linked to cancer. Because I don't think there's one illness that scares people more than cancer.
Linked to heart disease,
linked
diabetes,
to everything. Well, it's linked to everything.
Cancer, arthritis.
But I think cancer scares people more than all the others because we don't really have good treatments for cancer. We have treatments for diabetes. We have treatments for hypertension. Now, the best treatment for all of these is lose weight. But
do it properly. Very important.
So the statistic here is that obesity is frequently overlooked, an overlooked factor that can contribute to an increased cancer risk, yet less than 10% of Americans are aware of this link. According to the National Cancer Institute, an estimated 84,000 annual cancer cases are linked to obesity. And I would even say it's a lot more than that, because I think the whole country tends to be overweight.
Okay, well, in order to evaluate that, what are the total number of cancer diagnoses per year? Because they're saying 84,000 of those diagnoses are attributable to obesity. What is the total number of diagnoses each year? And might it be more connected with certain types of cancer? Or does that statement hold true for cancer diagnosis across the board?
Well, here's the thing. Everybody knows there's a connection between tobacco, smoking, and lung cancer, and lots of other cancers as well. But they don't make the same connection when you look at being overweight. And the reason people are overweight is because they're eating the wrong foods. It's not a thyroid problem. It's not a genetic problem. Maybe in a small percentage of cases is probably a genetic component. I don't want to say that it never is, but for the most part, it's what you eat. And the trouble is people don't realize that certain foods are better than other foods. For example, the obesity epidemic is directly related to excessive sugar consumption. And here's the problem. Virtually every single processed food is now loaded with hidden sugar and fructose, including baby food, foods thought of as health foods, and this is also a major driving factor for the cancer epidemic.
Absolutely astonishing information, I think, for people who are going to a mainstream grocery store and thinking that all of the foods that they're bringing home from that store are actually supportive of good health.
I think that's the problem. They think, well, just because it's sold in the store, it must be okay, that the FDA has approved it and it's fine to eat. Now, the link between a high sugar diet, obesity, and cancer can be summarized in two words, insulin resistance. Both obesity and cancer result when your body loses its ability to burn fat as fuel. And here's another point. Sugar also causes chronic inflammation, which also raises the risk of cancer. And there was a CNN article that stated fat tissue also produces hormones called adipokines, which can stimulate or inhibit cell growth. If these hormones are out of balance, the body may not be able to properly fight cell damage. One of the most effective ways to reverse insulin resistance is intermittent fasting, which we'll define in a moment, along with making some basic changes to your diet, which revolves around restricting your sugar and fructose intake and replacing carbs with healthy fats.
But how about this whole perspective that physicians aren't necessarily even testing people for meaningful categories in their blood, insulin as an example, to give people a viewpoint about what is contributing to the fact that they cannot lose weight or they are continuously gaining weight?
Well, physicians' focus is not on looking for the underlying cause of your problem or even preventing illness. Their focus is, what drug do I use for your symptom?
I tell people that all the time, that doctors are trained to treat disease. They are not trained in anything other than diagnosing the disease, putting a name to your symptoms, and then what pharmaceutical, what chemical do we use to minimize the symptoms? Not even get to what's causing the symptoms, just minimizing the symptoms so that your tests come back in a so-called acceptable category.
And that's why I call these doctors, and this pertains to the vast majority of doctors, probably 90%. The other 10% include the surgeons and the oncologists. But the vast majority of doctors are using drugs to treat symptoms, and we should call them what they are, prescriptionists.
Okay.
Now, there are a number of studies linking obesity to the increased risk of about a dozen different cancers. You asked about that earlier, what types of cancers? They include colon cancer, esophageal cancer, kidney, breast, and pancreatic cancer, and also increase your risk of dying from the disease. There was a 16-year-long study, which was published back in 2003, included 900,000 Americans, and they found that obese participants were more likely to be diagnosed and die from cancer compared to those of normal weight. And the authors of that study stated they could account for 14% of all deaths from cancer in men and 20% of those from women were related to the obesity. A recent report in the journal Cancer Research projects cancer incidence and death from cancer in the U.S. will continue to rise over the next decade and a half, in large part due to rising obesity rates. Now, there are other factors involved too, like genetically modified organisms. Now, what does that mean? That means that there are foods that are being manipulated genetically that we're eating because it's in the common food supply. But the reason they've genetically modified those foods is that they can tolerate exposure to herbicides and pesticides that are sprayed on the crops. So when you're eating those foods, you're also being exposed to those poisons as well.
Obesity associated also with changes in hormone levels, and that hormone contribute to changes that make people more vulnerable to a diagnosis of cancer. When it is particularly the hormone estrogen that seems to cause so many of the problems, and when you evaluate the impact of obesity on hormones, that risk for cancer development is there. When you evaluate antibiotic use, and not only antibiotic use on the part of the individual to overcome an infection, but antibiotics that are consumed as part of their diets on a regular basis. So that combination of situations all contributes to the obesity issue as well as to the risk of cancer developing.
So, but there's another risk. It's a two-part risk. One is, if you're overweight, there's an increased risk of getting cancer.
Right.
Now they did another study with 80,000 breast cancer patients, and they found that the premenopausal women with a body mass index over 30 had a 21.5% chance of death, whereas women with the average BMI of 16.6, in other words, they were thin, they had a body mass index over 30, had a 21.5% chance of death, whereas women with average BMIs, in other words, average being between 20 and 25,
right,
had a 16.6% chance of dying.
Okay.
So there are two issues here. Being overweight increases your risk of getting cancer and increases your risk of dying from that cancer. That's important, too. So one of the treatments people should do if they have cancer is lose weight. Now, why does that help? Well, in your fat tissue, you're storing a lot of toxins in your body, so removing them from your body can be helpful.
And in that fat tissue, you are because of the presence of that fat tissue, you are producing hormones. And those hormones produced in the fat tissue play a role in impacting your wellness.
Now, we used to talk about how many pounds of sugar Americans eat. I remember when we first started doing radio 30 years ago, it was only around 100 pounds a year of sugar.
And what is it now,
well,
Dr. Slavin?
You know, it's over 200 pounds of sugar, but now
you're kidding. Say that again. It's over
200 pounds of sugar
annually per capita here in the United States.
But a better,
that's outrageous.
But a better way of looking at it.
I don't think there's any good way of looking at it.
Well, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, found that most adults, that's over 71%, get 10% of their calories from added sugar.
10% of their calories from added sugar. But what that tells me is a very, very significant part of their caloric intake is processed food.
Well, that's true. And here's the other, the serious part is 10% of American adults get 25% or more of their calories from added sugar. So on average, Americans consume about 350 calories a day from added sugar, and that translates to 22 teaspoons. And this is behind most of the health issues that people face.
It's really interesting because people come to me and they'll show me a caloric breakdown of different foods that they're considering eating, vegetables, and so many times people will talk to me about carrots because carrots have a sugar content, and sweet potatoes, and they have a sugar content, and apples, they have a sugar content. And I tell them, okay, those foods, yes, indeed, they have a sugar content. However, they also have a fiber content that predicts how the sugar is going to be delivered to their bloodstream. And that makes a very, very big difference in overall effect of that food with regard to storing calories as fat. So it's very, very interesting. If they're choosing foods out of a package, crackers, breads, cookies, rolls, processed foods. One of the processed foods that comes to mind is macaroni and cheese. Those are the sugars that they need to be concerned about, not the sugars from carrots.
So when I was in college, I remember professors saying...
And you remember back that far, Dr. Slavin.
They treated all calories as the same. And that's a big mistake. All calories are not the same.
Are dietitians not considering all calories the same these days?
Do they still do that?
Well, I have to say I need a fact checker on that. But it seems to me that many times when I talk to people who have been advised by a dietitian affiliated with a hospital after a particular diagnosis or stay in a hospital, they haven't been given information that would have them differentiate between a whole grain, oats, steel cut oats as an example, and instant oatmeal. Huge difference in how those things are metabolized, and the dietitian's not going to point out the differences.
That same study showed that those who consumed 21% or more of their daily calories in the form of sugar were twice as likely to die from heart disease compared to those who got 7% or less of their daily calories from added sugar. The risk was nearly tripled among those who consumed 25% or more of their daily calories from sugar. So stop the statin drugs and just cut out the sugar. Right?
Well, what a novel idea. People don't realize necessarily that there is a connection with their sugar consumption and their cholesterol triglyceride profile.
That's absolutely true. They think they have to cut out fats, and that was the biggest mistake ever told to the In fact, you can trace the obesity epidemic back to the point when they said stop the fats and start the carbs. And that's when obesity really took off. Now...
The physician, Dr. Atkins, how he was ostracized, ridiculed, because he told people, go ahead and eat meat, go ahead and eat fat. It isn't those animal proteins and it isn't the quality fats that are making you fat or changing your blood levels of fats. And people were absolutely, he was at odds with the medical community over that.
The average American consumes about 22 teaspoons of added sugar a day. And here's the problem. Your liver can only handle about 6 teaspoons of sugar a day, unless you're exercising a lot. If you're exercising a lot, then you can tolerate more sugar. All the excess sugar that you take in is metabolized into fat, and that leads to all of the chronic diseases, including cancer. So, cut out the sugar now. So, how do you do that? So, here's some numbers for you to keep in mind. 4 grams of sugar is equivalent to 1 teaspoon. So, if we're talking about keeping it down to 6 teaspoons a day, that's 24 grams of sugar. So, you can look at labels now and you understand that doesn't
No,
help.
I don't think so. You're looking at labels. You shouldn't be looking at foods to have every day in your diet that come in a box with a label, my
Now,
opinion.
oh, here's another interesting thing. I just want to mention you. We mentioned sugar. You have to cut out the fructose because that's even worse than sugar. And you have to cut out all the artificial sweeteners because those are bad. But here's an interesting point. If you're among the 80% or the 80% majority who have insulin or leptin resistance, in other words, if you're overweight, you're diabetic, you have high blood pressure. But here's the other thing, or taking a statin drug. Because if you don't
Ooh.
remember, statins have been linked to diabetes now.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
You'd be wise
Okay.
to restrict your total fructose consumption to as little as 15 grams a day, which would be just under 4 teaspoons. But I don't know why you're doing that. Now, fructose, also found in fruit, right? So they're saying you don't want to overdo the fruit as well.
Well, that's it. People have heard for years, eat your fruits and vegetables. And I tell them all the time, no, eat your vegetables and maybe 2 fruits a day. If you have diabetes, it would be down to 1 small fruit serving per day. So, very, very important to understand that fruits and vegetables are not created equal. Dr. Slavin, you said something crucially important. Statin drugs are linked to diabetes. Let's hear a little bit more about that.
Well, that was a recent warning that maybe came out within the last year or so that statin drugs increase your risk of developing diabetes. The fact is that statin drugs, although it will lower cholesterol levels, you'll do your body a lot more good if you just cut out the sugar because that'll lower your cholesterol levels as well.
People have a very difficult time believing me when I tell them that they can change their diet by reducing cereals, bagels, toast, sandwiches, those kinds of things.
You
Oh,
just
somebody
enumerated.
is crying here because of what I've told
You
them
just
to
listed
skip.
the average American's diet right there. That's the problem.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, they have difficulty because they say, well, my doctor told me I couldn't eat red meat. I should cut down on the fats. And I tell them,
Yeah.
no, that is not the change that's going to support your health.
Now, here's the science. Cancer cells need glucose to thrive. So when I give patients a diet for cancer, number one thing on there is avoid sugar.
And unfortunately, they very often say, well, okay, I can have Splenda or I can have Equal. Dr. Slavin, do you tell them that they need to stay away from those
Yeah,
two, those, all of
exactly.
them?
Sure. I tell them, if you're going to have sugar, use organic cane sugar and just limit it. You don't have to have zero. Have it if you have 1 cup of tea a day, have a little bit there, and that's it. Now, if you're dealing with cancer, you have to lower your sugar consumption, your fructose consumption, and your grain consumption because you want to starve the cancer cells or prevent them from forming in the first place. So you eliminate your sugars in which include all non-vegetable carbohydrates. So vegetables are okay because they're a source of carbohydrates, but those are acceptable because they're not going to convert to a lot of sugar.
The two exceptions to that statement are white potato and corn. All the other vegetables people can have. Certainly, the green leafy vegetables, they have to be careful if they're dealing with any kind of pharmaceutical for blood thinning. They can still have those green leafy vegetables, but they have to have them in small servings and not every single day.
Here's a name you may have heard about, Otto Warburg. Now, if you haven't heard about him, he's made his mark. Back in 1934, he received the Nobel Prize for his research on cancer cell physiology. And he showed that cancer cells require more sugar to thrive. Then how come oncologists still haven't fully grasped the importance of this knowledge, nor do they apply it when devising a cancer treatment plan?
Unfortunately, far too many oncologists, when faced with patients who are losing excessive amounts of weight during their chemotherapy and radiation treatments, they tell their patients, go ahead, eat whatever you want, have ice cream, have desserts, have pasta, have pizza. And unfortunately, those are the recommendations almost guaranteed to ensure cancer cell growth.
Now, even in terms of treatment, cancer has been shown to respond to diet alone, a ketogenic diet. That's a diet that's high in healthy fat and very low in sugar, especially for those who are insulin resistant. It has been shown to reverse cancer in many cases, and research shows a lot of promise in this area. It can be very useful in addressing the underlying insulin resistance. Once the insulin resistance resolves, a ketogenic diet is typically not required. Now, how do you know if you have insulin resistance? Very simple. Do a 2-hour glucose insulin tolerance test. If you have insulin resistance, you may find that your blood sugars stay in the normal range, but your insulin levels go up higher than they should in order to control your blood sugar. So in other words, you can have normal blood. If doctors usually only check blood sugar. So you can have insulin resistance and not know it because your blood sugars could be normal. So if you look at your insulin and blood sugar at the same time in response to a glucose challenge, you'll see that you'll make the diagnosis of insulin resistance.
So it isn't appropriate to do a fasting insulin level. And then, Dr. Slavin, if you would talk a little bit about how A1C, glycohemoglobin, falls into this profile of evaluating someone's glucose status.
Sometimes you might pick up someone who has an elevated hemoglobin A1C or glycohemoglobin, but what that is reflecting is your average blood sugar over a 3-month period.
Right.
Now, you can still have insulin resistance and still have normal blood sugars.
Okay.
So in order to know at the earliest stages if you have insulin resistance, you have to do a glucose insulin challenge.
Not an insulin, a fasting insulin doesn't tell you anything relevant?
No, because
relevant?
A fasting insulin still might be normal. So in the earliest stages, it'll be normal. So here's how you do the test. You go to the doctor or the lab, and then the first test they do with fasting is they draw your blood sugar and your insulin level. Then they give you a measured amount of a carbohydrate, a drink,
sucrose,
a sugar drink. And then a half hour later, they recheck it. An hour later, they recheck it. And then 2 hours later, they check it. A normal response is by 2 hours, everything is back to baseline. The first thing to go wrong is your insulin stays up, even though your sugar goes back to baseline. And of course, if you're diabetic, everything stays up. Your insulin and your sugar stay up. And if you're a insulin-dependent diabetic, which you would already know that, so you wouldn't be doing the test probably. But in that case, your insulin doesn't respond to the sugar challenge because your body no longer can make enough insulin. We started off saying, you know, it's all about it's about obesity, which is about the amount of sugar you're consuming. And many times you're consuming it without even knowing it. Because you think you're eating a good food. I mean, Kellogg's has done a good job in that department. You're having cereal in the morning. It's all sugar. And they add sugar to the sugar. In In other words, the carbohydrate converts to sugar, and on top of that, they frost it with sugar and everything else.
It's a processed grain source carbohydrate, and because it's so very processed, all of the fiber has been removed, and unfortunately, most of the mineral and vitamin content goes out the door also. And it's one digestive pass, and that's glucose being delivered to your bloodstream.
So now I'm going to sort of summarize everything so you can implement it in your own lives. And the first thing to do is you avoid the sugar as much as possible. And that means the sugar that you recognize in the form of sugar or fructose, but also grains. And do away with processed foods. Now, how do you know if a food is processed? It's been packaged. It
comes
in a can,
in a package.
You know, it comes with a label. If it doesn't have a label, that means you've got fresh produce, or you're in the meat or poultry department, and you're getting it from there. You can have large amounts of vegetables, but here again, I have to recommend organic vegetables as opposed to regular vegetables. Janet, you have a thought on that?
I think it's a very, very wise
recommendation.
Ideally. I think, unfortunately, so many people have a budget constraint. So my first recommendation with regard to organics has to do with animal source products. And you want to stay away from any of those animal products that have been raised with antibiotics or hormones or genetically modified feed.
So the next point is you want to keep your protein content a little bit lower than you're used to eating. I think we've been told to eat more protein than probably is necessary. So it's low to moderate amounts of high quality protein. And by that we mean protein from grass-fed animals, protein from wild fish. Chicken's a tough one, though. I think of all the sources, I think chicken is the hardest one to get a good quality poultry.
And unfortunately, I believe that the contamination with chlorine goes across the board, whether it's organic or commercial.
The next part is fat, because everybody's been told cut back on fat, but the key is you want to eat as much high-quality fat as you want. Now people probably are thinking, what's a high-quality fat? Because they've been told all fat is bad. What's a high-quality fat? Well, and they've also been told saturated fats are bad. Not so. So you get saturated and monounsaturated fats from animals and tropical oil sources like coconut oil. The key with the animal sources is you want it from grass-fed animals. And most people actually need upwards of 50 to 85% fats in their diet for optimal health. A far cry from the 10% currently recommended. It's a big difference, a big switch over.
Very, very big switch. Unfortunately, people have been dramatically misled.
Just a couple of things. We said cut back on the sugar, of course, but they say stevia or Lujan is okay.
Stevia and Lujan are fine, but you have to be careful with agave syrup that has been promoted. That will seriously derange your blood sugar level. Honey will also do that. Maple syrup. So people do need to be careful with what their options are. Small amounts and you're safe.
Now here's something else. You know, I wouldn't think of buying fruit in a can, but a lot of people do. And the fruit in the can always comes with a syrup that's very high in sugar on top of what the fruit is. So you have, if you're going to have fruit, have fresh fruit. And the best fruit from a sugar standpoint are berries. You know, blueberries, strawberries, blackberries. And don't put sugar on top of them.
Yeah, don't put sugar on them. But the strawberries and the blueberries have to be organic. Those two categories of berries are very significantly contaminated with pesticides and herbicides.
Now, here's an interesting suggestion. Use spices instead of sugar to add flavor to your meals.
Cinnamon, vanilla extract, almond extract, there's banana extract. There's a lot of different flavors that you can use that are very, very enticing and delicious and even aromatic. That makes it an even more interesting dish to to consume.
Now, earlier we mentioned the term intermittent fasting, and that's really crucial if you meeting your goals. And by intermittent fasting, we mean you're going to eat during fewer hours during the day. So normally people get up in the morning, say 8 o'clock, they're eating, and maybe they don't finish eating till 8 o'clock at night or later. So that means for a 12-hour period, they're eating. So ideally, if you can knock that period down from 12 hours to 8 hours of eating, what does that mean? Well, maybe you start eating at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And you
skip breakfast, right. Dr. Slavin?
And you finish and you finish by 8 o'clock at night. Now you've narrowed that window to 8 o'clock, to 8 hours. And that's very important because it allows your body to make changes and to further enhance the improvement, exercise in the fasting state. And that'll give you additional benefit. And so a simple way to do intermittent fasting is simply skip breakfast. Make lunch your first meal. And that solves a lot of problems because when I tell people what they should eat, they say, well, what do I eat for breakfast now? Well, I've solved that problem. So you go to lunch, you have your vegetables, salad, and you have a source of protein. You do the same thing for dinner. Something else, the key is to limit your eating to a specific narrow window of time each day between 6 and 8 hours rather than eating every 2 to 3 hours. That's been the other thing, grazing. What's your opinion on grazing?
Well, there are some people who tell me that's how they eat. And if those people are thin, in general, they're going to be grazing on foods that are desirable. There's a person who comes to see me who is very, very slim, and her snack is a peeled cucumber, slices that she carries in a little snack bag, and that's what she's munching on in between her meals. But how many people would consider consuming a cucumber as a snack? Not that many.
If you eat the way we've just said, you're sugar levels are going to remain constant, and therefore you don't get cravings for food and you don't get hungry. It's when you put the carbs in that raises your sugar level, then your insulin level goes up, then your sugar levels drop, you feel hungry, and you go on a vicious cycle. And I think that's where that eating 5 times a day came in, or grazing, eating constantly. But if you eat the right foods, you don't feel hungry.
Proteins and vegetables. And unfortunately, far too many people, when I'm suggesting protein and vegetables, they're very disturbed that they have to eliminate their bagel or they have to eliminate their protein bar. That's a category of foods, unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily live up to their name. When you take a look at the sugar content, the carb content of the so-called protein bar, that those two categories, carbs and sugars, are far higher than the protein content in a so-called protein bar.
So, Jen, I just want to sort of summarize everything for our listeners. If you want to reduce, and in many cases, virtually eliminate your risk of cancer and other chronic diseases, you need to cut back on your sugar and fructose consumption to 25 grams a day. And we said that a teaspoon is 4 grams of sugar. So 25 grams is about 6 teaspoons a day. And on top of that, exercise is going to help, but exercise by itself won't compensate for a diet that's too high in sugar. So really, just pay attention to that. It can be done, and you'll feel a lot better for it.
You will certainly feel better.